You will no longer feel inferior. You will no longer feel small. You will feel powerful. And so the glib answer is we need families, we need containers, educational containers. We're losing all our containers. Families are breaking up. Containers are breaking up, within which people can struggle towards a flexible and resilient ego structure that can hold affects of love and hate, and that can do the work of integrating the shadow. And it's how we get more of that is anybody's guess. But meetings like this, where we're struggling to understand and struggling to admit and open to our own shadow stuff, are part of the answer. Do I find that the traumatized individual would find it easier to reject dehumanization? Many traumatized individuals that I know have an exquisite sensitivity to the abuse and mistreatment of others. On the other hand, I can also say that many traumatized individuals also have a very fragile ego structure, and they don't have access to their own aggression very well in the service of their own selfhood. So they can also be very easily influenced in situations like that. So I can't tell you for sure. I know that many people with a trauma history are exquisitely sensitive to injury of innocent people and innocent animals, creatures. Several people that I know and have worked with over the years have had just an extraordinary sensitivity to animal life, to pets, and have actually been very, very tuned into them to the point of almost psychic or paranormal capacities to understand what animals are thinking, feeling, and so forth. And that's another factor, by the way, which is very, very interesting. There's some new work coming out on the fact that people with a trauma history, early trauma history, seem to be psychic. And there's a book of correspondence coming out between Jung and J.B. Rhine, who was the one of the researchers in parapsychology at Duke University. And the woman that is doing this publishing wrote me recently, and she said, you know, you'll be interested to know that the people who we are studying, who have definable and reproducible psychic capacity, have all have a trauma history. So it's very intriguing that this privileged access to another dimension of reality seems to be facilitated by being broken open to that level of reality. Of course, it's a mixed blessing because, you know, many, many individuals, even though they have psychic capacities, they have trouble finding a way into human relationship. It also goes away when you heal? Interesting.
Yeah.
We have a question over here, and then we'll come back over here. Okay.
Somewhat picking up on where Mary was, because this thought was going through my mind before Mary spoke. But you know, if a woman is conscious when she becomes, even prior to becoming pregnant, I'll speak from my own experience. I was very conscious when I received my daughter's soul, where I received it, when I received it, and when then it actually, you know, became physical, which was almost 6 months later. So a woman who is in touch with that, it's not, the soul just doesn't, you're speaking of the soul once the child is in the world. The soul does enter into a woman's space, at least for me personally, prior to the physical manifestation. And I think that, you know, when we talk about that, the men wrote most of the psychology, you know, there is a soul, you know, given prior to the physical and the material world.
Fair enough.
And also to somewhat speak to what Mary was saying, I came here thinking that dying is a healing process. And some of these things that we were trying to resolve about how we parented our children or how we were parented, I'm learning really does not, for me personally, I'm seeing that some of this healing does not come until the dying process is entered into. I'll be honest, my mother is dying of cancer, and the healing that is going on within the consciousness of my family has taken years for resolution. Mm-hmm. And to see that this is breaking through consciousness within the entire family, yes, and healing places and letting go of aspects of the injuries and the traumas that were generated within my family line for centuries, mm-hmm, is finally, you know. So it isn't something that just happens overnight or happens if you're, even when you're consciously parenting. It is a process.
Well, we can all hope for that kind of integrative death process. It reminds me of a comment by Winnicott, a prayer that he issued, which was, "Oh God, may I be alive when I die."
I just want to tell a quick story about containment of archetypal affects, just real quick, and then I have a question. But just as an example, I'm part of the Quaker Intentional Village Project in Columbia County, and one of the things that I love about it is there are a lot of kids, little kids there, and there's a lot of people to care for those children. The youngest child is 3 and has recently been sick, and he's also going through a sort of a cranky stage anyway, but when he's sick, he's been very cranky. And we were in a business meeting, and his mother was taking minutes, and his father was clerking. And so, you know, here he was coming and sick and cranky and whining and just really awful. And, you know, his father was trying to hold him and clerk at the same time. And he couldn't. So his uncle took him. And we got to watch this wonderful process of this cranky child being held first and not being comfortable and moving around, and his uncle just, you know, holding him and letting him move and you know, swaddling him in his blanket, and, you know, and then slowly but surely, you know, them playing little face games, you know, you know, that kind of thing. And then after about, you know, 20 minutes, the child jumped out of his lap and ran off. Mm-hmm. And it was just one of the most beautiful healing things even to watch.
Yeah.
You can see that kind of thing. But the question that I have is about the you said there's two different stories. One is the I'm bad, the other is you're bad,
mm-hmm,
story.
Right, right.
And we know that one of the symptoms of trauma is that God also dies. That's one of the signs and symptoms, is that someone that believed in God might have lost their faith, mm-hmm, through the trauma. I just recently started working with a fireman that was at 9/11 and has had a whole lot of personal loss, he and his wife both. And they recently, they're Catholic, and they recently got pregnant, which they didn't really want. And then they found out the child was a Down's child. Mm. And this is their 4th child, and he wanted to terminate, and it turns out that they really ended up not terminating, but he is just devastated. He is just depressed and feels like he's never going to have fun again in his life. He's really in that position of, mm-hmm, you know, the world is unjust. This is my life sucks, mm-hmm, you know, and no matter what happens, it's never going to be good again. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to intervene. I don't know. I mean, I sort of have senses, but it's not my story, and I sort of don't understand it much. Can you say just a little bit about where to...
Oh, boy, that's so difficult. I mean, the first thing you can't do is talk him out of his cynicism. You have to hold that and be with him in it, but you can let him know that, you know, that maybe he has to borrow a little of your faith, that this suffering that he's going through right now with you, and that you're in it with him, will become a teacher for him of something that he doesn't yet know. And that sometimes will open up at least a curiosity, you know, that his image of God may have to expand beyond the image that he has now. and his image of what this birth of a Down syndrome child means may have to expand beyond anything he can conceive of right now. It reminds me of a wonderful story that Naomi Remen tells in Kitchen Table Wisdom. Maybe you know that book. She was working with a man who was an athlete and was on his way to extraordinary accomplishments as an athlete, and he had he broke his back in an accident and was paraplegic. And he came in to work with her, and he said, "My life is, for all intents, over." And he had the same attitude: "Life sucks. This is disgusting. You know, how could this happen to me? How could God do this?" And all the rest of it. And Naomi Remen gave him a piece of paper and said, "Draw what you're feeling." And he took a big black crayon and he made a vase on the paper. And then he took the black crayon and made a big gash down the vase. He said, "That's me. I'm broken." And she held him, and worked with him for a long time, and actually was able to get him involved in working with other paraplegics, and made him into a kind of a spokesman and therapist for a lot of others who were having this problem, and because he was extremely talented. And at the end of this work, he brought that painting back to her in their final session. And where the black gash was in the vase, he had taken a yellow, beautiful yellow crayon and outlined that whole black and yellow. And he said, "I realize now that this is where the light comes through." And it's a beautiful, transformative story about how trauma can be transcended, but it takes a long time and a lot of struggle. Back here, we have Mike.
Oh, good. In many communities, the shaman or the medicine man or the healer is the wounded healer, and I would appreciate any comments you might have about how effective a healer can be who is themselves wounded or has been and may not even have recovered from all of the wounding they've experienced.
I don't think there are any good healers who aren't also wounded healers. That's the way I would put it. While you're in the process of recovering from your wounding, you have to be somewhat careful in the process to differentiate your wounding from the wounding of the people that come to you for help. I'll put it that way, because a lot of the process of psychoanalytic training or depth psychological training is to help differentiate, you know, where your wounding stops and the client's begins. A lot of people who start into psychotherapy with their own trauma histories, and I've seen this in many candidates for analytic training, they have a very powerful, loving countertransference to the wounds of their clients, and they wish to rescue them from their pain and their suffering. And they're often very effective in the early stages of work with the trauma victim. But where they run into trouble is that they're not doing the work on their own stuff. They're doing it vicariously through the suffering and injury in the client. And so when it comes time for the client to integrate both aggression and love, when the client isn't just overwhelmingly grateful and idealizing and adoring of the therapist, and might need to separate from the therapist and have a struggle with the therapist and maybe even get into a fight with the therapist, the individual who hasn't worked through their own stuff has a lot of trouble. The wounded healer is, that's an archetype. The wounded healer, all the great healers of traditional religions and early periods in the archaic civilizations and mythology were wounded healers. Chiron, Asclepius, they're all wounded. Because they have access then through the wound to their own struggle, their own, and to the depth dimension of the psyche and soul. Now, if we continue with questions indefinitely, we're going to never get to this fairy tale, so let's limit it to maybe two more.
Will you talk at some point over the weekend about the issue of trauma for children who are ages 3 to 5 or older than that?
You mean particularly for the older children?
Yes.
I'll make an effort to do that.
Thank you.
Yes. One more?
I may not understand your history, but I thought I read that you started off with a theological bent.
You're right.
And I was going to just posit and say, if that were the case, I've heard you speak very incisively about Buddhism and its understanding of suffering, about Christianity and its understanding of incarnation, and about Judaism and its understanding about the face of God. And I'm just wondering, have you ever stepped back and looked at what you're doing there and how you're doing it? Because I think it's a very beautiful thing that you are doing. And I'm just wondering if you've ever reflected on it.
I reflect on it all the time. I don't know to what end. My big crisis at the University of Wisconsin before I started my theological training was Jesus Christ, myth or reality. I had grown up in a Presbyterian church in Marshfield, Wisconsin, the same church that Melvin Laird attended. Do you know who he was, the previous Secretary of Defense? I had been relatively unthinking about what I was learning as the biblical story and my Christian understanding and my Christian beliefs and so on. And then I got to the University of Wisconsin and I started to go around to the various chapels and so forth. And this question began to intrigue me, partly because I was starting to read Paul Tillich and Bultmann and Reinhold Niebuhr and some of the great theological minds at the time. And it wasn't until I read Jung's introductory essay to Psychology and Alchemy that I got an answer to that question. And of course, Jung's answer is, it's not Jesus Christ, myth or reality. It's Jesus Christ, myth and reality. He asks in that essay, he says, we've been concerned with the truth or falsity of these religious stories for far too long. We have to start asking, what's the deeper truth in these stories that accounts for the fact that they have been around for thousands and thousands of years and have meant the world to so many people? And it's not just the Christian story. It's the story of the Buddha. It's the story of Krishna. It's the story of Zoroastrianism, of the prophet. Islam, it's all of these great avatars are individuals who have been touched by an image or the presence of the divine and tried to bring that into some form in the realm of human suffering. And I'll never forget when I was, one of my moments in this crisis was at the University of Wisconsin in Bascom Hall, and I was reading the story of an ancient historian named Josephus about a god whose death and rebirth was celebrated at the winter solstice around the 21st of December. And this god was associated with, I believe he had a virgin birth, and I believe he was killed inside, his death was associated with a tree on which he was pinned. And Josephus, and I thought I was reading about the Christian story, and Josephus said, this is Osiris, and goes back 1600 years before the Christian story. Well, that was my first moments like that in our lives, I think, tend to open us up to something beyond our literal categories, because I remember walking out of Bascom Hall that night. I remember it was about 7 p.m., and I heard the bells tolling in the carillon, and I knew that I had just had an experience that opened me to something beyond what I had previously been open to. So Jung, I think, takes that understanding and expands it in ways that have opened up the whole field of psychology and religion to me. And thank you for your comment. I hope I haven't answered it, but I've responded to it. Okay, you ready for a fairy tale? I think we should take a stretch.
I'm going to ask a real dumb, quick question. You can't. You're saying that the ego gets left behind, and so then the kind of vision, sometimes a vision allows the soul to reconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does that, so the soul can reconnect, but the ego, where's,
how about the ego?
Okay. The girl without hands. Now, let me say a word about how I'm going to approach this fairy tale and the second one also, Tomorrow, the Waters of Life. Fairy tales, as I understand them, and as we will try to approach this one, have a great deal to do with how, through the individuation process, how a relationship is worked out between the world of mundane reality and the ineffable world of spiritual reality. How does this going to happen? And in this case, we have a story about a traumatic experience, of course, and so that's why I've chosen this story, because I think it gives us a sense of what has to happen in order for that to be healed and how it starts in the first place. So, in other words, fairy tales talk about the process of humanization, how and healing of the split between the archetypal and the human world. Now, if we're going to understand this tale, I think in the deepest way, we have to think about every figure in the tale as a part of a whole personality. Okay? We can look at it through other lenses. We can look at it through the lens of this terrible father who we could look at the tale through the lens of the terrible father, or we could look at the tale through the lens of the father-daughter relationship. We could explore it in terms of many, many dimensions, and none of those would be off or wrong, and I hope you'll feel free to look at the tale in whatever way it strikes you, because these stories, when we read them, hit us in different ways. They're very psychoactive. They may touch us in our father complex, our daughter complex. They may touch us in a trauma complex. They may affect us in all kinds of different ways. But the way I'll be trying to move us in terms of our discussion is in terms of looking at the story as a whole story about a hypothetical personality. Now, if we did that, let's see where that understanding takes us. I'm going to precede the first part of the tale just to remind you of what happens, and then we'll talk about it, okay? I'd like to do this in a process of discussion with you so that I'm not just lecturing about the tale, but we have some conversations going. A miller has fallen into poverty, which is, you know, quite frankly, an interesting fact. Most millers are not in poverty. The millers in these early villages tended to be rather wealthy. But this one has fallen on very hard times. And he's off in the woods cutting wood for his family. And this was something that would happen in these early villages. The surrounding forest was sort of everybody's domain, and so you could go out and cut your wood in the woods in the surrounding forest. And he's working very hard to fill up his impoverished life with wood, and he runs into this old man who steps out and says, "Why do you plague yourself with all this work, all this cutting of wood? He says, I'll give you something for nothing." Now, if you read a lot of fairy tales, you know that the person that steps out and says, "You can have something for nothing," you know, it's just like the state lottery. You can have something for nothing. Just cough up, you know, all your earnings. Why do you plague yourself with cutting wood? I'll make you rich. All you have to do is promise me what's standing behind your mill. Well, the old man thinks to himself, well, the only thing that is behind the mill is the apple tree. I can get rid of the apple tree. So he says yes and signs up with this stranger. So he goes home, and his wife says, "What on earth has happened? All our chests and coffers are filling up with money." And he says, "Well, I met an old stranger in the woods, and he said we could have great wealth if I just promised him what was standing behind the mill." And she says, "Oh, my God, our daughter's just been out there sweeping the yard. You just gave away our daughter." So, plot thickens. The man is very chagrined, and the evil one has said, "I won't come for 3 years." So you have 3 years. And the story says that that the girl, who is very beautiful and pious, lived through these 3 years without sin and in fear of God. And the day then finally came when the evil one showed up to fetch her. And in order to prevent her from getting hurt, she washed herself completely clean, made a circle around herself with chalk, and his first visit, he had no access to her, he had no power over her, and he left. But he said, "Take all the water away from her. I don't want her washing herself." See, the evil principle can't get at the innocent when it's completely clean. It has to have some entree through a flaw. So they take the water away from her. He comes the next time. But she's wept so copiously on her hands that he can't get at her again. So he says to the father, "Cut off her hands." The father says, "Oh my God, I can't do that. This is my daughter. What are you talking about?" And he says, "If you don't cut off her hands, then I'll take you instead." So the father goes to the child and says, imagine this conversation, "My child, if I don't cut off both your hands, the devil will carry me away. And I confess that in my terror, I promised to do it. Help me in my need." Help me in my need, right? This is great. "And forgive me the harm I do you." She replies in her selfless, totally selfless and pleasing way, "Dear Father, do with me what you will, for I am your child." Well, so this gives us a little clue as to what the problem is, at least for the daughter, doesn't it? She has no self except as identified with the father. She has, or pleasing the father, or pleasing whomever else is in the neighborhood. So she lays down both of her hands, and the devil chops them, or the father chops them off. It was an interesting slip. Because he's been taken over now by this demonic energy. So he chops off her hands. The devil comes for the third time, but she now has wept so long and so much on the stumps of her of her dismembered hands, that they are completely clean. He has to give in. He's lost all right over her. This is the third time. So he recedes into the background. We don't lose track of him because he has another very important role to play in the story. Now the miller, wealthy, goes to his daughter and says, I've caused you great trouble, and I'd be happy to keep you in great wealth for the rest of your life if you will stay here with me. And she says, here I cannot stay. I will go forth. Compassionate people will give me as much as I require. So she caused her maimed arms to be bound to her back, and by sunrise she set off on her way and walked the whole day until night fell. So here we have an image of really almost abject masochism. She's already been maimed and injured and wounded, and she has her arms tied behind her back. We don't know why that is. We could imagine why that is, so that they don't show. But it's also an image of submission or arrest. You know, if you're arrested and taken away, your arms are tied. It's immobilization. And so she wanders off into the world. She comes to, the moon was shimmering, and she saw trees that were covered with beautiful fruit, and they grow inside a garden which is inaccessible because it's surrounded by water. Now, a circular garden in myth and image is frequently related to what Jung would call the construct of the self. It's a premonition of wholeness. First of all, it's a fruited garden. It's on an island. It's surrounded by water. Jung made a great deal of the mandala as a sign of what he called the self. And the mandala has these two dimensions that are combined within it. A circle, which frequently connotes infinity or eternity, and a square, which frequently connotes time and the temporal or the material world. So you have combined in the mandala then a kind of spirit matter conjunctio. So wherever you find circles or islands, particularly gardens, you have an image of the self. The Garden of Eden was a similar kind of garden. She can't get over the water, and so something very important happens that we'll see in our other fairy tale too. She kneels down. She says, I'm going to die of hunger. She kneels down, calls upon the Lord, and prays. In other words, she turns it over to her. The ego is out of gas, can't do anything anymore. She falls on her knees and prays to God, and an angel appears. Now, the angel what happens here. She kneels down, calls upon God, and prays. Suddenly, the angel comes towards her. The angel makes a dam in the water, which is apparently flowing in the circle, so that the moat becomes dry and she can walk through it. And now she goes into the garden, and the angel goes with her. And in this garden, which belongs to a king, there are pear trees. And the pears apparently are very special pears because they're all numbered. This is an unusual garden. The fruit is numbered. So she leans up with her mouth, her hands tied behind her back, and she eats one of the pears from the tree. The gardener, who is watching this, is very afraid because he thinks that the maiden is a spirit, because the angel, all dressed in white and luminous, is standing right next to her, and he doesn't distinguish between her and the angel. So he alerts the king. Or no, wait a minute. The king comes down the next morning and sees one of his numbered pears missing. And that's why they're numbered, right? And he says, well, what's going on here? How did my favorite pears suddenly lose one of their number? And what's going on? And the gardener says, well, you won't believe this, but last night a spirit seemed to come here, made a dam in the water, crossed over here, and started eating that pear, ate a whole pear off the tree, and then retired into the bushes. The king said, well, for heaven's sakes, if that's as you say, I want to come tonight and see this. And if it's a spirit, I'll bring a priest with me so that the priest can talk to the spirit. Now, the next night, then the king comes, and the priest goes out, because the daughter comes out, eats the apple, has the angel standing next to her. The priest goes out and says, do you come from earth or from heaven? And you see, about we're already getting this interesting question, earth or heaven, angel or human, mortal or human. And the girl says, I'm no spirit. I'm an unhappy mortal deserted by all but God. And at this moment, the king falls in love with her. And he says, if you are forsaken by all the world, I will not forsake you. He takes her with him into his royal palace. And because she is so beautiful and good, he loves her with all his heart. And he has silver hands made for her and takes her to wife. Now, that's the first part of our story. And we'll get to the second part in a moment. But we ought to say something about this first part. What is a king? Because there's so much royalty in fairy tales. It's amazing. A father. Okay, yes, it's a father. But archetypally speaking, kings are the royal personality. They are often, yes, they're certainly power. Order and justice, they are all of those things. And they represent usually, this is the way Marie-Louise von Franz would put it, the prevailing order of the culture. They represent the authority and the prevailing order. And because they're royal, in early cultures, the great individuals that were elevated to royalty, and there was a whole lineage and line, were usually understood as being either divine themselves or having some kind of connection to divinity. I mean, that was true even up to 1946 when the Japanese emperor was understood to be divine. So we still have this kind of thing hanging around in certain cultures. So anything that partakes of that divinity, or what Jung would call the self, see, the image of the self in the psyche is that numinous and transcendent dimension of the whole personality. So we have an image of wholeness. Anything that's connected to royalty and divinity is almost always connected to wholeness. Now, the king falls in love with her. He can see her wholeness despite her dismembered condition. He loves her beyond her injury. And this is the first step in the healing of her trauma. We could think of her as, because she's dismembered, we could think of her as the part of the psyche that is dissociated. She's feminine. We could think of her as the father's injured feeling function. Lots of ways we could think of her, but the way I'm approaching the tale, she is dismembered. She is dehumanized by virtue of the fact that parts of her have been lopped off. She's not whole anymore. And consequently, she has no self as agency in the world. Her self as agency in the world is completely crippled. She seems to be completely identified as the child of the father. So she can do very little but please others. And she is completely at the behest of the compassion of others in order to survive in the world. But the world sustains her. The world seems to take care of her. Because as she prays, when she falls on her knees, the angel appears. Now, just a couple of words about this before we open it for discussion. The act of falling on your knees when your ego resources are exhausted is almost you could almost make a rule in fairy tales. When this happens, when the hero or the heroine is finally at the end of their rope, when they are finally at the very, the ego is exhausted all of its resources, and there's a collapse in the effort to continue, there's supernatural aid is almost always available at that moment. So that's the moment that the angel appears. You saw this in the story that I just told you about the Mother Mary and the baby Jesus at in this flight. This little girl was completely without hope. She thought she was going to die. She wanted to die. She had lost all hope, and she was simply at the end of her rope. And it was at that moment that the vision appeared. And that vision sustained her. And this angel sustains our dismembered daughter. Now, let me say a moment about something about what happens when the king falls in love with her, and then I'll talk a little bit more about her. I like to think of this moment when the king falls in love with her as what happens when the person who has suffered terrible traumatic experience, either through a loving relationship, a spouse, a therapist, whomever, when someone sees your wholeness. I remember a therapist once said to a client of mine, this is the one thing that he remembered from his previous therapy, is that his therapist had said to him at a moment of great suffering, "I see your wholeness." In other words, this therapist didn't say, "I see your injury," or "I see you as identified with your injury." The therapist said, "I can see you whole despite your injury." And I think we all depend on that in order to, you know, we become so convinced that we are inferior, so convinced that we are reprehensible, so down on ourselves for our failings. And then when somebody sees us whole, it constellates that primordial wholeness that we've lost in the injury of our trauma. It reminds us of that wholeness that is implicit still in us somewhere and that wants to be linked up to reality again. And the king makes her silver hands. Well, now this is very interesting. It's would we call that a complete healing? Not really. Because really, she can't fully, she isn't completely healed yet. She has hands given to her by him. That's the silver hand stage. But she can't really completely love him with hands he's given her. If you understand what I'm saying. If you've been rescued by someone out there in the world from your terrible trauma, and they've given you the means with which to go on about your life, you feel a deep sense of gratitude. But oftentimes, it's only the first stage in a couple of stages before you grow your own hands. Nonetheless, it's a crucial and important stage, the silver hand stage. And the nature of her suffering during this stage and the nature of her healing is also the first stage in her ultimate healing. We'll see how it differs from the next stage in a moment. I want to say more about her now, this dismembered part of the self. Because this is something we encounter in our work with trauma survivors a great deal. And it's one of those two stories that I told you that the trauma survivors may tell him or herself. One is, the world is bad and I'm innocent and I'm a victim of a bad or bad and unjust world. The second is, I'm bad. And this is much more common. I want to give you a couple of examples. This is a story told to me by a patient who was herself a psychiatrist and very successful in the world person, but carried around deep inside of herself, and it would appear in dreams, a deep sense of shame, and she couldn't figure out what this was. Well, we started to unlock just the experiences that she remembers that were associated with this shame. Here's one. She's 5 years old. The family has just moved to a new house. She's extremely happy. She's full of enthusiasm. All the neighbors are out to greet them at this new neighborhood. The moving van is there. She's going to have a room of her own. And in a moment of complete and utter enthusiasm, she runs down off the stoop where she's standing with her mother, picks a bouquet of flowers, and brings them up to her mother and says, "Here, Mommy, this is for you." Now, that's a moment of total enthusiasm. Do you know the root of enthusiasm, what that word means? Entheos. It means the God is in us. We are totally possessed at that moment of a moment of total passion and infusion of energy, animated energy. The mother looked down at the bouquet, looked at the little girl, and realized suddenly that she had picked these flowers from the neighbor's yard. And she said, no, Helen, how could you do this? Now you take those flowers and you go and apologize to Mrs. So-and-so next door. And she dragged her little girl by the hand down the steps over to the little girl, and she said, "Now, Helen, you tell her you're so sorry that you did this." Now, this is a very anxious mother. An anxious mother who's very concerned herself to please. And good heavens, God forbid that her child should make such a mess of neighborly relations on this first day in the neighborhood as to pick the flowers from her future neighbor's garden. Now, what my patient remembers is a deep feeling of shame at that moment. And I think this is one of the primary affects of trauma, shame. It's a feeling that there's something about your very life energy that is bad. That you're somehow not right for just, there's something wrong with your instincts, your very aliveness. It's very different from guilt, where you've done something bad. She knew she had done something bad, but she felt shame to the core by that experience. And it didn't take her very long as a little girl to have a very serious eating disorder and to start wishing that she weren't a little girl at all, that she was really a boy. And this led to various problems of anorexia and so forth. But it's this bad self-representation that I want to talk about. Another client told me that she felt all her life that she had a black core. That there was something like coal or carbon compressed at the center of her. She said, "I feel like this black core of me contaminates other people." She said, "I feel like if people stay too close to me, they might catch this. There's something toxic or contagious about me." Now, this terrible burden of a maimed sense of self, of a failed self, a deeply injured bad self, is, I think, the depth of of what comes to us in all relationships for healing. Because it's the interpretation that the child makes of its own suffering. This little girl whose mother did that, and this mother was not a bad mother, all things considered. I mean, she was basically a loving person. And, you know, if this kind of thing didn't get repeated time and time again, this patient of mine would not have ended up feeling so deeply ashamed of her inner world. But these things tend to accrue once they get started in the psyche. So I think this totally self-effacing, undeserving, maimed, inferior sense of self is what this the handless maiden feels like. And it goes off into the world, and for the first time in its transformation, it's loved by this king, given silver hands, and taken to wife. Now, this is a major point of transition in the story, so you want to talk about this first stage? Oh my gosh, I see we're already out of time. Let's have a couple of questions, and then we can we'll come back to the second stage of this story tomorrow.
It seems to me the first stage is, even though she has surrendered to her father, she leaves her father's house.
Yes. That's a very important comment. She does not stay with this father. She knows that her healing or her life is going to have to be outside this environment, doesn't she? Here I cannot stay, she says. So that's the first step in the individuating journey, isn't it? And the first good sign that she is on her way to something different than being this totally masochistic, pleasing daughter in thrall to the father, right? Now, see, the devil is what starts the story. The father makes a pact with the devil. You could say that this is his individuating journey, but we're looking at this story as a whole. So, the reality is that the person with a serious trauma history usually makes some kind of pact with the devil to give up the self, to surrender the self in order to survive. And that's what's happened in this story. Now, it's on the way to healing because the king falls in love with her. He sees her wholeness. Just to precede the next stage, the king then goes away on a journey. I'll remind you of this again tomorrow. But the king goes away on a journey, and he leaves the queen, now pregnant, with their little boy, soon to be born, in the hands of his mother to care for. And he says, by all means, keep the queen in good shape and let me know by letter what happens. So the child is born, and the mother sends a happy letter to her son, in this foreign land, and guess who intercepts the letter? The old evil one again. And he intercepts the letter, and he puts a letter in the hands of the messenger that says, your wife has given birth to a monster. Well, the king receives this, and he sends a letter back. He's deeply grieved and upset, but he says, for heaven's sakes, take the best care you can of the queen and the child, and I'll be home as soon as I can. This letter gets also intercepted by the evil one, who says, puts another letter in the place that says, kill the queen and the child. Well, when the mother gets this letter, she can't believe it, and she refuses to kill the daughter-in-law and the child, and calls the woodsman and sends them off into the woods with the woodsman, and gets a deer and has its tongue and eyes cut out, which is another directive from the devil to prove that the child and the queen have been killed. And she says, you cannot stay here, but I cannot kill you. Please go as far away as possible and don't ever come back. So the woman then goes into the forest again. This is the second, this is exile now. This is the second stage. Now, however, she has a child, and you know what the child's name is? Sorrowful. So she has her child, she has her silver hands, and she again wanders into the forest. This time, she falls again on her knees and prays, and this time a second angel comes to her, and she finds herself led to a little house that says, "Here all live free." And she enters this home. The angel introduces herself to the queen, and she stays there for 7 years. And during those 7 years of bringing up Sorrowful, her own authentic hands regrow. Now that's the second stage in the healing, and what we want to think about is, what's the difference between the first kind of suffering that's done at the silver hand stage in the healing of trauma, and the second kind of suffering that's done as she regrows her hands and is sorrowful her child is coming into being? Because it's in the understanding of those two levels of suffering that I think the main key to our tale lies. And I think it also gives us some insight into how we heal our own suffering and the kinds of stages of our own suffering that we have to go through in order to heal. So we'll leave it there for tonight and see you tomorrow. Thank you.